Hi, you're listening to Stefan Levera Podcast, a show about Bitcoin and Austrian economics brought to you by Swan.com. Is there a shift and a different way of thinking about Bitcoin merchant adoption? Will Cole from Zaprite rejoins me on the show to talk about his thoughts on this idea, as well as why many people are getting the concept of the circular economy wrong. Will, welcome back to the show.
Stefan, thanks for having me, man.
Lots of things going on. I know you and Parker have recently shifted over to Zaprite, so we're going to chat about that. And I don't know, you and Parker perhaps have been working on some ideas around the way we think about Bitcoin. So let's start with a little bit of that. And maybe you just want to tell us a little bit about the shift to Zaprite as well. Let's start with that.
Yeah. I guess, you know, in our little world here in Austin, it was a big move for us. Parker and I left Unchained back in November and took a little break, first of all. Like you, I was third time over, becoming a father again.
Congratulations.
So born in February and took a little bit of time off for the first time in, 20-something years. And Parker was writing his book, so that was nice. And then, of course, we got pretty itchy there after just even a few months of not going into the office every day. And really, obviously we knew we wanted to work in Bitcoin and we were just exploring. And, you know, for me in particular, while building Unchained and working with that team, you know, I just have tunnel vision and can't really think about anything else going on. I don't look at competitors. I don't really look at what's going on in the industry. I'm just sort of focused on us and our customers. And it was really kind of a great moment for me to see, you know, what's been happening in Lightning since 2019, you know, what's been going on in the world of Nostr, you know, all those types of things. And what's going on in the world of mining. And so we were really just trying to find problems that hadn't been solved or hadn't been solved well. For me personally, you know, on the product and engineering side, I like these things I call like in-between businesses, right? I consider Unchained to be an in-between business where the problem we were solving, on one hand, you had, you know, full custodial exchange setups like Coinbase or Kraken or Gemini or something where a lot of people keep their coins. And on the other end, you had people, you know, putting single sig devices or multi sig devices in their home safes and just trying to figure it out. And Unchained kind of found this like in between space that they could live in where, you could do multi sig, but maybe because of collaborating with Unchained, you would actually do it, you know, instead of just saying, yeah, it's the best way to do it, but I can't do it. I think Mutiny is another one of those types of businesses. Lightning Wallet, you know, I'll admit, after Node Launcher, Pierre Richard's Node Launcher stopped being active, I stopped doing non-custodial Lightning. It was just kind of a pain in the ass. It was even kind of a pain in the ass back then, but I was just using custodial Lightning. And when Mutiny came around and I could set up a non-custodial Lightning wallet in 30 seconds, like what a beautiful in-between business. And really, it's just a question of what are you going to abstract? Like, you know, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You are going to make sacrifices. And so that's where my mind always went to. And that's where I was going to when I was thinking about what I wanted to work on next. It's like, what is the ideal of what someone can do? And then how do I make sure people actually do it by giving up a few of the things and making it easy enough to do? So this is a real roundabout way of saying, we looked at a lot of things. I was looking at mining. I was visiting coal plants all over Wyoming and trying to figure out how, Bitcoin miners could, own their actual energy production. I still think that there's a big horizon there, problems to knock down. And then when we were looking at payments, the real thing that popped up was, I want to accept payments for things that I do. I want to be able to contract and charge in Bitcoin and things like that, but I don't want to run a server was basically the question the problem I was trying to solve. I love BTC Pay Server on one side, but it was a lot of overhead for what I wanted to do personally, what Parker wanted to do personally. And then, on the other end of that, spectrum, you had like the open nodes or BitPays of the world where it's, fully custodial, counterparty risk, all those types of things. And I didn't want that either. It was more like, I already have wallets that I like, single sig wallets, multi sig wallets that I like. I just want the money to go there. I don't want an in-between step. And it just turned out that there really wasn't anything out there to do that. And so Parker and I were really ready to go out there and try to do something in the e-commerce space with just that. But then we remembered there was a guy that worked in at a Pleb Lab in Austin, had also worked out of the Bitcoin Commons a bit. His name's John McGill, and he had started this company, Zaprite, and it was really around contracting, right, invoicing. And we talked to him a little bit about the e-commerce setup. He'd already kind of built the back end that that we had envisioned. Turned out he had a really similar vision of where he wanted to take Zaprite, so we just joined teams, right?
Great. It
made a lot of sense.
Great. And so, yeah, I think you've spelled out, I guess, where Zaprite sits, because obviously many listeners will be thinking, oh, hey, I could just run my BTC Pay server and blah, 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 right? Which, of course, that's a great option. I, you know, support that. I use BTC Pay myself. But there is, like you said, this in-between group of people, and that's a sizable group of people. And I think it's important that we, obviously you and I and probably many listeners, maybe many of us are kind of in the more, let's say, hardcore camp, but there's a lot of people where we need to get out of the echo chamber and reach people and make Bitcoin easy for them. I think that's really what it is. It's trying to get more people in. And, you know, I think it's interesting to talk about this as well, because sometimes people maybe frame it in the wrong way. They say it's kind of like mass adoption at all costs kind of thing. And to me, it's not that. It's more like, how can we expand the pie of Bitcoiners? And it's still going to be a relatively small group of people, broadly speaking, right? So, you know, where we are today in the world, how many self-custodial Bitcoin users are there? Probably less than 1% in terms of the global population, right? Something in that range. And we want to get to like 10 or 20%, right? Like at least what services can, you know, that marginal person who's like the 5th percentile person, not the 1% percent, you know, person, right? But how are you thinking about these questions?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think about it strictly from like a product mindset, right? You know, that's how I've been thinking about the world for, you know, 20 years now. And, you know, from a product mindset, that, you know, there's the ideal of what we know, you know, the value of Bitcoin to be and how to obtain that value of the censorship resistance of, you know, all those types of attributes that we talk about every single day. But how do you get people to actually do it, right? And what are you willing to sacrifice along the way? So like in the Unchained case, I can make it very simply. We could get people to be fully self-sovereign at the expense of some privacy, right? So it made a lot of sense for people that already had KYC coins, that weren't using mixers, that weren't doing those things, that had inheritance, you know, things that they wanted to think through, right? And they would give up that privacy, but they would maintain sovereignty, right? And so I don't pretend that these in-between type of businesses or products don't have costs associated with them, right? However, you know, That's up to the entrepreneur to decide about what's the best trade-off, right? The Mutiny guys, I think they made the perfect trade-off with the Mutiny wallet, which is like, you can have, excuse me, you can have a non-custodial Lightning setup, but you, we're going to manage liquidity for you. It's just not even an option. We're just going to do that, right? And I think that's a beautiful, you know, trade-off for me. Now, it's not going to be for everyone, but it is, I think, a very reasonable segment of the marketplace is going to find that really attractive. With Zaprite, it's the same sort of thing, right? Where we are going to make, you know, you don't get to run your own server, right? That is a trade-off that some people might not want to make. But if they like their custody solution, right, and they don't want that type of overhead, it could very well just be because they're a small business and they don't have the ability to run a server, right? Some people don't have that ability, even though it, you know, it's not the hardest thing in the world to do. It is overhead, right? Or maybe they have certain uptime requirements that they can't, you know, do themselves. So I think about these things about, like, you know, in terms of adoption, is like the ideal is I want people to be sovereign over their wealth. I want them to minimize their counterparty risk, right? I think that that's of the problems that we're trying to solve right now, maybe the most important one to do, right? I had focused on the custody side. How can we help people who want to earn in Bitcoin, you know, get that same benefit with never taking that first step? And I don't know, maybe some of your listeners will be familiar with this as well, is that I actually got inspiration from the fiat world, which is a company called Modern Treasury. A lot of the Bitcoin companies out there that, you know, deal with credit card processing and things like that, and Stripe can be your best friend one day and then tell you that they hate Bitcoin companies the next day. You know, it's just kind of murky out there on whether or not these big payment processors are going to do business with you. And then in comes a company like Modern Treasury, where they don't take custody of funds at all. They hook up your bank account to your customer's bank account, and they're making direct payments to you, bank account to bank account. And it's a one-time setup. And I looked at that and thought, like, well, if they can do that in the fiat world, like, I'd like to do that in the Bitcoin world.
So let's talk that through a little bit. So in the Zaprite setup, the only experience I have with Zaprite is actually, funnily enough, buying Parker's book. So as a customer, like an end customer, like paying, I've seen it. But what does it look like for, you know, Parker or for you? Can you just talk through what that looks like in terms of, you know, I presume in that case, Parker is self-custodying the coins, or it's, you know, being maybe if there's a Lightning custodian, he can withdraw those. Like, can you just walk through a little bit where the custody is sitting and a little bit of that setup?
100%. Yeah. So with Zaprite, what we've decided to do is be sort of wallet or custody agnostic, right? It's bring your own wallet. And the two main use cases right now are for e-commerce. You're selling something online. It could be a ticket or a book or an event or, you know, whatever that might be, or a single product SKU or, you know, whatever that is, or you're a contractor. We do invoicing as well. And the whole idea behind this is that you have these things that we call connections. And you come in and you just say, like, okay, what's my custody setup? Oh, it's a Trezor. Okay, I can throw an XPub in and we'll increment addresses. And whether you're selling something online or you're invoicing to, a company that you're working for or something like that, you can get the Bitcoin sent directly to that. We also give you fiat rail options, so you can, if you're charging in dollars and in Bitcoin, you can use like a Stripe account or a direct ACH payment. But the idea is that we're not trying to get in the way of a customer's custody choice, right? So now most of our customers are choosing self-sovereign options. So that's, you know, either a single SIG, XPub, or say like an unchained configuration file to go straight to like your multi-SIG setup. However, some of these merchants do need to do exchange. They do need, you know, if they get too much Bitcoin in, they might need to get some dollars out because they have obligations in dollars and payroll and things like that. So you could also come in and bring your Strike account, for instance. And that way, if you're getting too much Bitcoin, you can always exchange some out. And there will be more of those options coming down the line. You know, we're working with River and other companies to make sure, you know, at the end of the day, we're trying to be sort of custody agnostic, although making sure that that self-sovereign use case of choosing the custody with all the myriad ways you can do self-custody, making sure that that's seamless on
So that, I guess that's from an on-chain perspective. What about from a Lightning perspective? How does it work there in terms of the custody? Like, does Zaprite offer that Lightning aspect, or do you need to bring your own or roll your own for that? Or can you just walk us through that?
Again, it's sort of like on-chain, where like if you have your own L&D, setup, you can hook all that into Zaprite as well.
Gotcha.
Or you could just use Strike. We're going to be adding more options, more wallets as it goes. This is from the merchant's perspective. From the buyer's perspective or the payer's perspective, you can use any wallet, right? As long as they're accepting Lightning or accepting on-chain and you have a wallet that works, you can send them money.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay, great. And so, yeah, I guess that's a little bit about Zaprite. And let's talk a little bit about this idea that, you know, we were talking about offline, which is the narrative shift, let's say. So as, you know, just setting the context, as it seems to be a common idea, and I probably agree with this idea, which is that we're going to go store of value, and then later we're going to transition into medium of exchange and then unit of account. And I think, famously, Nick Szabo popularized this idea. Vijay Boyapati mentions this kind of idea as well in his bullish case for Bitcoin. And I see that as a logical thing. Even though I personally spend, I recognize that most people are just going to be hodling, and hodling is going to be the very highly dominating use for some time to come. Now, of course, I would love if we were all living on Bitcoin today, but I also recognize that's not where we are. But I'm curious your view there.
Yeah, I mean, Nick Szabo influenced me incredibly along my entire Bitcoin journey. what he wrote post Bitcoin and even pre Bitcoin in that sense. But yeah, I think that, you know, I've definitely been aware of this narrative at least since 2016, right? Is like focus on the store of value side, focus on custody, focus on these types of problems right now. Because and I buy into that logic, because even if you wanted to accept Bitcoin as payment, if there weren't satisfactory custody options out there, it's kind of moot, right? The first question that a merchant or anyone trying to earn Bitcoin has to ask themselves is, if I got Bitcoin, what could I do with it? Could I keep it safe, right? Otherwise, I'm just going to exchange it out immediately. You know, I don't even blame companies like BitPay, you know, that came really, really early on, where like the number one part of their business was just exchange, right? You know, storefront says we accept Bitcoin, but merchant accepts dollars. It's like, well, if you're around in 2014, maybe that was the best option, right? You know, the custody options were few and far between at that time. It was more difficult to self-custody. I think a lot's changed in the last six, well, more than that, 9 years since those types of companies are around. There are a lot of really strong custody options now on the self-sovereign side. Multi-sig, single sig, open source, you know, companies like Unchained or Casa, you have a lot of options. And I wouldn't go so far as to say that like custody solved, but the options out there, I think, have reached a sort of threshold of quality to where any reasonable person who wanted to accept Bitcoin can find a satisfactory answer out there for storing it. Now, once that has cleared from the person who wants to accept Bitcoin, now they have to accept Bitcoin to that place, right? Because if they understand the value of Bitcoin, of accepting Bitcoin to begin with, one of the things they're going to want to avoid is the counterparty risk that comes with full custodial options, right? If you can't do that, then using Bitcoin or accepting payments in Bitcoin, it's not pointless, but it's been, you know, sort of damaged in some way. You're not really getting the benefit that you could be. And so I do think that this next wave, and I think we're at the very beginning of it right now, and we'll see it a lot in whenever the next bull market comes about, is that outside of people just going to exchanges and buying Bitcoin, one of the ways they're going to stack sats is by accepting it in their businesses, probably starting up grassroots from small businesses. These are individuals who have unilateral decision-making abilities at their companies and with management of the treasury to say like, well, I want Bitcoin for myself personally, and I'm out there, you know, earning money in the market. You know, I have an e-commerce store online, or I'm a lawyer who has, you know, this roster of clients, and I'm relatively self-sufficient. I get to choose how what people pay me in. And that the demand for payments is not going to come because, you know, we go hassle a bunch of point of sale, you know, restaurants or something like that saying, hey, you should really accept Bitcoin, because then they're just going to turn it all into dollars immediately anyway. It's going to come from those people that have made, who understand the value of Bitcoin and have the decision-making power over their business to say, I want part or all or, you know, whatever it is of my treasury denominated in Bitcoin. And one of the easiest ways they can do that is just to get it at the point of sale, wherever they are selling. So I have heard a lot of, you know, counterclaims to this. I don't even think that people that don't view the world this way are necessarily wrong if you look at it from like a historical perspective, but I'm trying to, you know, see where the wind is blowing. And logically, what makes sense to me is that it is going to be these merchants that sort of set off the next adoption curve of, because they have the sort of power to make that decision.
The lead sponsor of this show is Swan.com. You can use Swan.com or the Swan app for your smartphone for safe and easy Bitcoin buys. Swan.com makes it easy to buy Bitcoin with a recurring purchase plan, or you can do a one-time buy, also known as a smash buy. Swan offers free custody in your own legally owned trust account, also with automated free withdrawals to self-custody. So make sure you withdraw your coins to your self-custody, and Swan.com has a range of services. Whether you are an everyday individual, whether you are a high net worth individual, you are a business looking to stack sats as part of your corporate or business balance sheet, and of course there is Swan IRA, a retirement product for those of you in the USA. So go to Swan.com to sign up over there. Now, when it comes to merchant adoption, if you're sending on-chain transactions, always remember to go to mempool.space. Mempool.space is a fully-fledged multi-layer ecosystem viewer. So you can see Bitcoin's blockchain, you can see Bitcoin's mempool, you can see second layer networks like the Lightning Network. And with mempool.space, you don't even have to trust a third party. It's free open source software. You can host it yourself and you can do all kinds of things like explore Bitcoin transactions. You can scroll across mempool blocks. They also have a mempool accelerator integration coming. So keep an eye out for that one. And you can find all of this and more information over at mempool.space. And now back to the show. Interesting. And so the counter view right now, as I said, I spend Bitcoin myself. I earn and spend. I try to live natively Bitcoin. But I suppose the counter view might be like, hey, it's too early. We're not there yet. Maybe it's another cycle. What would you say to that idea? Because, you know, the principal, I guess, counter argument, well, main two counter arguments I can think of is obviously number go up. Why would people spend their coins? Because they would rather hodl. Number two, in many countries, capital gains taxes. So what would you say as to why, you know, now or in this current, you know, coming cycle and not, you know, a future cycle?
Sure. Well, I don't know for sure, right? I'm making a bet right now. I'll point back to, you know, say early 2020, right? The same argument was being made around multisig, and that it was just too confusing. The market wasn't there yet. And at the beginning of 2020, that was the current state of things. There were, you know, maybe low number of thousands of people using multisig. I mean, you could see the transactions on chain, right? It was a very, very small percentage of wallets that were being spent from, that were multisig wallets. And I know from, you know, working at a place like Unchained in early 2020, we didn't have a lot of customers, right? But over that year, it got a little bit better. And then in 2021, there was an absolute freaking boom, right? The doubters didn't predict that. Not even Unchained. We didn't predict that, right? We were making a bet that sometime soon, people were going to make this leap. I'd say that I'm making the same sort of argument here on the merchant side, which is, look, at the end of the day, there are people that want Bitcoin, right? And the best way to get it right now, for the most part, is just to go out and buy it with your dollars, right? There are going to be people out there that they find a more efficient way to obtain that Bitcoin, right? The reason I'm choosing merchants and not, you know, buyers in this case is that I think you're right. The incentives on the buyer side right now is not necessarily to spend their Bitcoin. I think that merchants are going to put people into a sticky place here. I think that they will discount their products if you pay in Bitcoin. You already see that in some places. You know, my favorite VPN out there is Molvad. If you pay in Bitcoin, you get 10% off. Like, these guys fucking rule. They have a great product. And for that type of discount, I'm happy to pay in Bitcoin, right? I also think that reading the tea leaves in terms of, you know, capital gains taxes and things like that, I think it's very likely that we end up with, at least in the United States, with a de minimis, you know, amount of Bitcoin that can be spent without capital gains. I think that's almost inevitable. I don't know what that number is going to be, but I think for most normal purchases, say anything between zero, you know, 1 cent and, you know, $200 to $600 is going to be exempt from capital gains taxes. I don't think that we need to rely on that for this to be successful necessarily. But I do think those types of things are very likely to pop up here, you know, rather soon. But most of all, I would say that the people spending Bitcoin, right, are going to be put in a position that they're not being put in right now, which is the daily things that they want, whether it's, you know, someone's Shopify page, or, you know, they're paying for, you know, paying a lawyer or paying an architect or something like that. If those people want to be paid in Bitcoin, they're going to have to figure it out.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, and so I think, I'm parsing your argument this way, as it's going to be merchant-led in certain ways, because those merchants will prefer the Bitcoin to the fiat. And so that's the thesis that you're putting forward. That's the idea.
Yeah. I mean, if we think that people want Bitcoin at all in the future, merchants are a part of that, right? They're just people that want Bitcoin, right? If there are satisfactory ways in order to keep that Bitcoin safe, if they're if they can find ways to obtain that Bitcoin without some of the downsides of going to an exchange, without some of the counterparty risks that they would take otherwise, there are a lot of benefits actually to taking Bitcoin directly from your customers, right, and directly into the custodial solution that you prefer. I think that this actually becomes the preferred way for many people to get Sats.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to point out here that we're saying merchant, but even individuals can be a merchant in this context, right? Because an individual, instead of just being an employee of a company, maybe he is now a contractor and he's billing people and they could be all around the world. And for them, it may literally be easier to pay with Bitcoin than to pay than to do fiat wires. And so it may actually be easier to use Bitcoin. And that individual, who in this context is a merchant, he wants Bitcoin. And so this is, I guess, so Zaprite could offer, and Zaprite is not just US, right? It's
worldwide. And your use case right there is the foundation of how Zaprite started. That's John McGill's entire story, right? So he's an Irish citizen, right, who is doing a lot of work in the United States. He's a contractor. He's a designer. You know, he's a technologist that has a lot of clients. He wants to be paid in Bitcoin. None of the invoicing options really work for him. He builds Zaprite to scratch his own itch, right? And where Parker and I came in is that, you know, John was very, very far down the line with that invoicing product. It's very popular amongst Bitcoiners around the world. And where we came in is we wanted to, you know, expand that into the e-commerce, you know, and eventually, you know, other spaces. But that the mechanisms, right? If you imagine what he's actually doing in that, the product that he's building is basically a UI and a user experience wrapper or just around your wallet and my wallet. I do some contracting work for Stefan. Stefan needs to pay me. It's just connecting your wallet to my wallet through this invoicing front end. Same thing that we're doing now with payment links on the e-commerce side. But very much what you're talking about is exactly why Zaprite was built, was just on the individual contracting level.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. So it makes a lot of sense then for particularly in the contractor case where you have a payment request. Now, if you weren't willing to run your own BTC Pay, then that's where Zaprite can make it very simple and easy. And that, I guess, comes back to that question we were saying before around getting outside our echo chamber of, you know, people who are maybe not at the level that they can run their own BTC Pay. And that's where Zaprite can sort of open the door, make it easier for businesses and individual contractors to take payment in Bitcoin. And, you know, even from the end user purchaser's perspective, they might be using some other solution to kind of get around their own capital gains taxing, as an example, like the Strike use case, right? Like they might just be literally pulling out their Strike app, paying with fiat on their side, but the merchant or the contractor, the Zaprite user in this case, is still getting their Bitcoin that they wanted. So it's sort of easing.
It's the opposite of what BitPay was doing in the early days, right?
Right.
So like BitPay was just taking in, you know, Bitcoin from, you know, me and you and turning it into, you know, dollars for the merchant or for the contractor or whoever, right? It's kind of inverting that. Absolutely. And Strike was one of our first, you know, custodial integrations exactly for that reason. The other thing that I would say in all this is, and this really comes from Parker, but I'll do my best, to sort of summarize his thoughts on this, is that, you know, whether you're an individual or you're a small business or big business, you know, having Bitcoin at all is a balance sheet decision, right? A lot of people have already made that balance sheet decision, right? MicroStrategy has already made that balance sheet decision. Block has already made that balance sheet decision. Most Bitcoin startups have made that balance sheet decision. And you and I as individuals have made that balance sheet decision. So the only question at this point is how do we get it, right? And right now, almost everyone, including MicroStrategy, including Block, including most of the startups out there that keep some of their treasury in Bitcoin, they're going out and they are, you know, buying Bitcoin on an exchange or OTC or something like that with money they raised or money that piles up from their customers, right? So they've already made the decision that they want Bitcoin. We've made it and those companies have made it. Now, the question is there a more streamlined way to receive that Bitcoin, right? I think there's a big enough market of people that have already made that decision to really lead to a boom in these, you know, I won't call them, you know, kind of in the payment processing world to start building out that use case on Bitcoin Rails.
Fantastic. And so this does also get into the question around circular economies, right? And I know you have thoughts on this. I think you were saying you believe it's a bit of a misconception. Why do you believe this term of circular economy is a misconception?
So this is something that, you know, John and Parker and I have talked a lot about, right? For Bitblock Boom, Parker put up a infographic that was basically saying, like, here's this imaginary theory of the circular economy where you have all these nodes of people around and they all connect to each other, you know, in this perfect sort of like web of payments. But that's not actually how things work at all. Not in the least. What happens is that you hire a plumber and the plumber bills you. And he bills you in Bitcoin and you have to make a decision, right? It is transactional. It is peer-to-peer, right? It is company to customer. After a long time, a gradual buildup of a lot of people making a lot of individual decisions that benefit them for whatever balance sheet decision they've made, you get something that looks like the circular economy, but it doesn't start that way. And it doesn't need to be bootstrapped in a way where you say, like, well, the network isn't valuable until all these people are connected in this way. It's like, no, you just need a lot of individual decisions. And with the amount of Bitcoin education out there and with the growth of people wanting Bitcoin in general over the last, you know, 15 years, right? What we see is that there are more and more people making that individual decision saying, like, I want Bitcoin, right? So there's not a circular economy, right, at all. In practice, it's just individuals saying, hey, I'm doing something for you. I'd prefer it if you pay me in Bitcoin. It's a very simple, simple idea, right? And that once enough people make that decision, it starts to look like a circular economy, but it is a gradual buildup, just like anything else in Bitcoin has been gradual, right? Understanding Bitcoin was gradual. Understanding how to use Bitcoin was gradual. Understanding how to store Bitcoin was gradual. There's not going to be a moment in time, some sort of singularity where everyone just starts trading in Bitcoin. It's just going to sneak up on you after a long period of time. At first it was just the people writing books about Bitcoin that were accepting Bitcoin, and then your electrician's going to ask you for it, and then, you know, it's just going to keep on happening and keep on happening to where you, as someone who, you know, has Bitcoin, is going to have to figure out your own balance sheet strategy of how do I spend and replace, or how do I start earning in Bitcoin so I don't have some of these, you know, balance sheet issues.
Right, and so it can also bring up thoughts around what people call circular economies, as an example, famously Bitcoin Beach, El Zonte, and, you know, many others around the world. I know there was an early one in the Netherlands as well. I think it's called Arnhem something. I can't remember the exact name. Anyway, there's a bunch of these. But to the point you were making, it's not necessarily that the people in these economies are only earning from other people in that same town or region. In many cases, their income may be coming from outside of that region, right? And this comes back to even just a general broader economics point, which is, you know, sometimes people confuse this as well. They confuse this idea of having like a trade surplus or a, you know, a current account deficit. Like, they sort of get a little bit confused in thinking that, oh, just having a trade account, you know, surplus is a good thing, and because you're kind of earning more than you're spending. But the reality is, in many cases, there will be different individuals who you have a surplus or a deficit with, right? For example, if there's a convenience store near me and I go buy, you know, sparkling water or something every now and then from them, well, I'm not earning any money from them. I'm only spending to them. I only have a deficit, right? Because I buy stuff from them and I don't earn anything from them because my income comes from elsewhere, right? So it's the same kind of idea that it's not necessarily going to be that you can only earn out of other people who are also Bitcoiners yet, you know, and maybe over time it will. But, you know, I think it's a bit of a misconception in that aspect too.
Yeah, I don't have any big brain, you know, theories for your listeners here. It's like, if your electrician is going to do a job and he wants to get paid in Bitcoin, right, you're going to have to fucking pay him in Bitcoin. You're going to have to figure it out, right? And what I'm saying is, it's becoming more and more rational for those people to charge you in Bitcoin, right? It was always kind of a weird thing that we ended up in, where a lot of the payment processors in the Bitcoin space, where their main business was exchange, right? The problem was, is that there weren't a lot of people that wanted to accept Bitcoin, right? And so in order to build a Bitcoin payment system, your main job was to convert that Bitcoin into dollars. Right now, that's probably still a bigger market than people accepting Bitcoin on a direct basis without exchange. I see that world changing, right? I think it will be gradual. I think it happens merchant to merchant, but it's totally rational, right? Especially for like you said, cross-border payments or anything like that, is that, it is a rational decision for a merchant to make to opt out of the fiat system as much as it is any individual who wants to opt out of the fiat system, right? I find people that are skeptical of this to be a little bit odd in their thinking at this point, is that the people that run businesses are just people, and they're going to make the same rational decisions that we make for our individual families and for our own balance sheets, right? It seems inevitable to me, even if a little bit early right now, but it is happening.
Yeah. Any comments on the accounting and compliance tooling and things like this? So as an example, if you're a businessman and you want to take Bitcoin payments, you might already have some kind of fiat-based accounting system, and that's been one of the traditional difficulties, is kind of having the Bitcoin side of it and then needing some way to integrate the two. In some cases, it might be simple as just having a CSV and then give that to your accountant and they kind of mix it all together. What's your view? Is Zaprite doing anything on this, or is this still kind of,
Yeah, and I mostly view this through like the Zaprite mindset right now, which is essentially, to start out with, you just need all the information. So if you're accepting Bitcoin, you need to know certain things, right? Like, how much Bitcoin did you get? What was the exchange rate at the time of the transaction? All those types of things that you would need to report on, later. And right now, that's exactly what we do. We build this nice CSV. You have everything you need to import it into whatever accounting software you might use, or just to send to your accountant in a really nice way that they can manipulate and, get all the stuff that you need. In the future, we will do more direct integrations with accounting systems, the QuickBooks and NetSuites and things of the world, building out a nice webhook, system. So whatever you're using, you can, just create little events that will eventually, just go straight into your accounting software. All of that is going to be, something that grows on the Zaprite side over time. But the most important thing is right now, what you can get is every single piece of information you need to do the bookkeeping compliantly in your jurisdiction for accepting Bitcoin. It is really important long term, especially, as you have more complex businesses, accounting gets more and more complex. And so you'll need those integrations into the NetSuite. That's not really our customer base right now, but it will be soon. And so that is on our radar, something that we're working on. We have one upgrade coming out next week on that. Yeah.
Back to the show in a moment. When it comes to merchant adoption, you need to make sure that you are self-custodying your coins, and CoinKite.com make it easy for you to do this. They have hardware devices such as the Cold Card, which you can use to self-custody your coins, and this is a phenomenal device. It's very secure, it has all kinds of features, it's very reliable, and it makes it so easy for you to secure your coins. If you are a beginner, you can just buy the Cold Card and get a USB-C cable, plug it directly to your computer, and use it with desktop software such as Sparrow Wallet, Spectre Desktop, or Electrum. If you're intermediate or advanced, you can use more advanced modes such as micro SD cards. You can use Seed XOR or Trick Pins. And of course, if you're advanced, you can use multi-signature. There's so many options, and you can use this to self-custody your coins and even do this as a merchant by using the XPub feature like we talk about in this episode with Will. So go to coinkite.com, order your cold cards either for yourself or your family or your friends, and get a discount with the code Livero. And now, back to the show. Great. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about where things are going, maybe a little bit more broader, maybe a little bit of macro, a little bit of, talk about where things are with inflation. Are we in a recession now? I think this is sort of some of the conversation now, and I'm curious if you have any views on, what recession means for Bitcoin. Like, will Bitcoin take a hit if it becomes clear later that, the US is in a recession right now. Do you have any thoughts on whether that is going to push people into Bitcoin, or perhaps there'll be an initial sell-off because there'll be people who maybe have to sell something?
Yeah. You know, I'm not a macro guy in general, but I do have thoughts on this, and, for your listeners, that might sound very simplistic, but seems simple to me, which is, I'll start this with saying, like, it always kind of amazed me that Bitcoin took off. I don't want to say like so fast, but, where it seemed like there were a lot of Americans proportionally into Bitcoin very early on, right? And the reason I found that surprising is that, relatively, we had good money compared to a lot of other fiat currencies around the world. When you have the petrodollar and you have a large demand for your dollars, you're actually in a pretty good position compared to a lot of other countries. It surprised me how little Bitcoin took off in the very early days in the Venezuelas and, Lebanons of the world, although they seem to be catching up, pretty quickly now. I think that anyone who experiences inflation, and for Americans, for many Americans, this is the first time they've experienced it at any rate, over 15%. And I'm not talking about the CPI, I'm talking about actual inflation, right? I think we've seen inflation, at or around 10% many, many times in my lifetime. But this is the first time where we're seeing it at 20, 25%, right? And when I talk to people, and these are anecdotes, it's not a secret anymore. I'm a lot of people's Bitcoin friend or Bitcoin neighbor or guy who sits next to them at a baseball game, Bitcoin guy. And you can see them starting to ask more questions because look, the dollar ain't shit, right? They're noticing this for the very first time in the United States. There wasn't a lot of pressure to understand Bitcoin or to value it because, again, you can look around the world and relatively speaking, if you're an American, you're in good shape. You're not feeling like you're in good shape anymore when you go to the grocery store and you have a family of four or five and your grocery bill is $400 and it used to be $250. And then someone's telling you that, well, there's only 8% inflation. And you're like, fuck off. That's not true, right? That can't possibly be true. It costs $100 to fill up my Suburban and it costs $400 to buy groceries. It was less than half of that 2 years ago, right? It doesn't, you don't have to have a sophisticated macro view to feel that in the United States anymore. And as we know, because of the dollar standard around the world, we export inflation to other countries. We export it to China and anyone that holds our debt. And so those countries are feeling it even more than Americans at this time. And it's only been happening for about a year, year and a half at this point. And so, I do think about that. And I do think that, all of those people that are experiencing this for the first time, they have a Stefan Levera, they have a Will Cole in their life who has talked to them about Bitcoin at some point over the last 10 years. They're going to be like, wait a minute, like, what about this? I can give an example. I mentioned the baseball game thing isn't actually, a made up thing. I'm sitting next to someone who owns a fairly, successful, restaurant franchise here in Austin. He owns the entire business and they franchise. They have like six locations in Austin. And I talked to him about Bitcoin like 3 years ago, around 2020. And he wasn't that interested. It didn't really appeal to him. And, towards the end of the season last year, we're sitting next to each other and he leans over and he's like, okay, tell me a little bit more about this. And I asked him why he wanted to know more about this. And the reason he wanted to know more about this is because everything in his business, whether it was labor costs or production costs or rent, everything was skyrocketing. Everything around him was skyrocketing. And he saw his treasury balance just being absolutely decimated, right? More than decimated because of inflation. It was the first time in his life that he had to confront what we all knew was inevitable, which is the dollar can't hold its value. And he was seeing it rapidly happening, right? I do not know how merchants, I do not know how independent contractors are going to avoid this for much longer. In fact, many of them are making the choice not to. And that they can't avoid it, right? And that they have to make this step. I do think that we have some tooling in the Bitcoin world that we can build to make that transition easier for people, which is why, you know, I focused on custody for a long time, and now I'm focusing on the, you know, direct payments, is I think that that order of operations makes a lot of sense. And I really don't think people are going to be able to avoid this. You know, in 2021, you know, I think back, and I just forgot the name of the book. I think it's When Money Dies, about the Weimar Republic.
Adam Fitzgerald, I think. Yeah.
Yes. There's a line in that that just haunts me. And Ferguson. Yes. Yeah. There's a line in that that like haunts me. And I think about 2021 in this sense, which is the well-to-do Germans in the Weimar Republic, as hyperinflation started, the quote was, "We all thought we were getting rich." Right. And I think in 2021, that's how a lot of people felt. We all thought we were getting rich, right? But it was just a mirage, right? So what happens after that is the next, you know, 3-4 years of our lives. And I'm not claiming that it will necessarily be as bad as the Weimar Republic in the United States or anything like that. But like, it doesn't just stop, right? It doesn't just go away. It's not some Paul Krugman fantasy where it's like, well, it was 10%, now it's 8%. You should be happy. It's like, well, it's still bad, right? The groceries are still going up. The gas prices are still going up. The housing prices are still going up. This is all bad for us. Of course, his argument would be, you know, well, if you just don't count energy and you don't count food and you don't count cars and transportation costs, it all looks okay now. It was like, well, yeah, if you take out everything that matters in life, it might not, you know, inflation might not look that bad. But if you're being realistic about it, there's no getting around it, right? So yeah, on the macro side here, it's that the illusion of the 2% target, I think, did a lot for making people not understand Bitcoin. But that contract's been broken completely. Now it's not just that inflation is and always has been higher than 2%. It's now noticeable in a month to month rate if you're living in Ohio, right? That not only is it not 2%, not only is it not 8%, but it's 20%, it's 25%, right? And when that happens, it crushes people's not just belief system, but it crushes their understanding of money completely. And I would say trying to convince a lot of people about Bitcoin over the years is one of the things that has always been surprising to me is how mad it makes people when you confront them on their understanding of money, right? It makes them angry, not curious, right? And you kind of have to back off. Now, I think that people will be more receptive. They won't be so angry when you say, hey, doesn't this kind of suck? Doesn't this make no sense that like you can't just keep a dollar and spend it in a month and it's still worth a dollar, right? That, you know, a car that you used to be able to buy for $50,000 is now like $105,000. Isn't that weird? Under a 2% inflation target. I think that the whole illusion of the Federal Reserve's competency in managing the monetary policy of the US dollar has been shattered for tens of millions of people.
Will a lot of people simply chase into other assets there? Will they just chase into property or into other things instead?
Yeah, it'd be nice to be able to do that. And historically, that's what people have done, right? I do think gold will do fairly well. I mean, I don't know. I think real estate and property, people are going to think twice, you know, especially, you know, a lot of that money was going into the commercial space that hasn't done so well. I see a lot of sweaty brokers in downtown Austin right now with, you know, 30%, you know, or 70% occupancy rates. No, I mean, like, you know, of course, some people will do that. And I do think that there are assets that are better than dollars. There are a lot of assets that are better than dollars. But for people that want to stay in, you know, a cash or cash equivalent, that want to do more modest savings without taking the risk of those properties, I think Bitcoin is going to, you know, especially over the next few years compared to any other time frame that we've seen with Bitcoin, that far more people will be finding refuge in Bitcoin than ever have before.
Yeah, I also think it's fair to point out that the awareness is there now that I would say most people in the Western world have heard of Bitcoin. Maybe they don't hold it, or maybe they, you know, they kind of had a crypto punt a few years ago and they kind of, you know, forgot about it, neglected it. Maybe now's that second or third touch point for them, that now they're going to take Bitcoin more seriously. So maybe that's also a little bit of what's going on. I think one other angle that's interesting is that there may be some people who think, well, hey, if we're going into a recession, maybe they want to hold some dollars because they think that, you know, assets are going to be on a fire sale, right? That I'm holding some dollars because they want to pick up property on the cheap, or they want to buy stocks on the cheap if they're expecting, let's say, the stock market to drop a lot in the next year or so. So I guess that might be for some people why they still want to hold dollars or short-term US treasuries, because of that expectation, even though they still believe in high inflationary expectations.
Yeah, I mean, again, historically, that would be the rational behavior. I think that, you know, for the more sophisticated, you know, investors out there, they're going to have to realize that, you know, Fed policy has become so, you know, dominant. Like, it's one of the best things about working with Parker is every time I try to come up with a theory about what's going on in the world, you know, money wise, he's just like, dude, it's just the Fed.
Yeah.
Like, stop trying to think about anything else. It's just the Fed, right? And what else does the Fed do? Like, the Fed has made it pretty clear that propping up the stock market is one of the, you know, they will kill the bond market in order to prop up the stock market. Any, you know, if they have the choice to do so, is that, you know, we could go into a recession, which I think we're in, and the stock market could be totally fine, right? You're not going to be able to pick up stocks on the cheap. You're not going to be able to do those types of things because the Fed has made it its policy to pick up those assets and buy them themselves and create a demand when that goes down. It's like the stock market going down is just not an option anymore, right? Once QE happened the first time, a lot of people said it at the time, you can't really unring that bell, because now that you've shown that you have that tool, what is your excuse for not using it?
Yeah. So zooming out a little bit, as we've spoken about today, we're talking about merchant-driven adoption of Bitcoin for payments. And so I guess zooming out, obviously, you were around, or you were familiar with what happened in 2013 and 14, right? That was kind of the merchant adoption days. And we didn't have Lightning then. So I think Lightning is a genuine game changer there. And so what we saw was a lot of, let's say, businesses who took Bitcoin, but then they stopped taking Bitcoin. And then that was crucially used as an argument by, let's say, some of the Bcashers saying, oh, look, XYZ company, they took Bitcoin, now they don't, you know, etc. Now, of course, we have Lightning, and Lightning actually makes a lot of these things proper, and it works a lot better for this kind of, you know, commerce, low to medium value commerce, let's say. Obviously, high value commerce, you still do that on chain anyway. And so, yeah, I guess where does it sort of boil out? Do you think this time is going to be different now because of Lightning and because of the custody improvements?
I think absolutely. And I think more than, I mean, Lightning is obviously, you hit the nail on the head. There's really two variables, right? The custody improvements, I think, are number one, right? It's just the ability to save Bitcoin in a manner that I'm comfortable with over a long period of time is, it has to happen first. There's no way you can just bootstrap this thing from, you know, medium of exchange, unit of account before the store of value argument has been solved, problem has been solved. And again, I'm not saying it's completely solved, but that there's enough out there now to where I would call it familiar. Anyone who's familiar with banking and holding dollars can find a custody solution that is familiar to them and is also beneficial to them, right? From there, they have to be able to accept it. I do think that this time will be different, or I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. It doesn't necessarily mean that I'm right, but I think that all of the signs of how people are going to accumulate Bitcoin in the future are pointing to this, right? I also know that it's inevitable. It will happen. Maybe it won't happen this cycle. Maybe I'm wrong on that, right? Maybe it happens in 10 years, but it is going to happen. And just like multisig, and just like so many of the groundwork that we had to lay before, is that as people make this decision to start moving Bitcoin into their unit of account, right, the thing that they want to accept, the way that they, you know, value their own balance sheet, the more they're going to demand it, you know, as compensation for their services, right? I think that logic is sound. I think that the macro environment that we're seeing right now with, you know, a unprecedented in the last 50 years inflationary, you know, economy that we live in, that all of the all of the prerequisites we need for those individuals to start making those logical decisions are here, right? And the next 3 years, I think, is very important for that.
As you spoke about before, in 2021, there was what's called the wealth effect, right? As the stock price went up, people felt like they were wealthy, they could spend more. And I think it's also fair to say that happens in Bitcoin too, right? As Bitcoin's price goes up, you see a lot more people willing to spend, right? You look at, let's say, Bitrefill data, obviously that kind of thing goes crazy during bull cycles. And you know what? Maybe that is also that each time we go around, we do this go around, there's a whole new bunch of people who are willing to earn and spend just natively or using an intermediary partner to sort of help them. I think each time that group of people who are willing to actually day-to-day use Bitcoin is growing. And so I think it comes back to individual choices. Individuals are going to choose to accept Bitcoin and to spend Bitcoin, and that is what's going to drive that next level. And for some people who are more on the outside, they can look at that and see, oh, wow, hang on. There are businesses who take Bitcoin. There are, let's say, Bitcoin Beach and these communities who are doing it. And so it really does work. So I think maybe that's where it sort of it all boils down for me. What do you think?
I think that even the premise of this, anyone who's stuck in 2013 or 2014 is making a very big mistake. The idea that something didn't work back then, not working now because it didn't work back then, is hilariously like shallow thinking, right? And I know that it can be hard to get out of. I've heard people call this, the loser's curse, right? And you see this in investing a lot, which is, I bought Apple in 1997 stock and it tanked on me. And yeah, it's doing good here in 2004. But I'm not going to buy it again because, I've already been down that road with this company before, right? And you can sort of extrapolate that into any type of decision, right? This loser's curse of having a bad experience with something in the past and then not having the confidence or even having an open mind to consider that it could be different because there are different variables at play this time around. 2013, 2014 Bitcoin, it's just a hilariously different world than we live in today, primarily because of the two things that you mentioned, the custody options and the existence, not just the existence, but the sort of maturity of the Lightning Network. I would even say in 2020, I had a lot of questions about, the Lightning Network working, right? People could still have those questions today, but there's been a lot of risk, de-risking that has gone out of that, answering that question of whether or not Lightning is going to be able to scale the way we want it to for these types of payments, right? It doesn't mean it's 100% going to work, but, if you were 50% sure in 2020, maybe you're 90% sure now, right? I would say I've definitely gone through that sort of change over the last 3 years myself. Back in 2014, I think that the narrative was, everyone was aware that the on-chain payments, other than the Bcashers who were delusional about this type of thing, everyone was aware that we were going to have to solve the on-chain problem, that it wasn't going to happen on-chain. And a lot of people warned about that back in 2013 or 2014. The idea that the predominant narrative in Bitcoin in 2013 or 2014 was that we were going to do all these transactions on chain is silly. It wasn't the dominant narrative. There were a lot of people loud about it, but you can't fool me. I was there, right? There was a narrative around it. It was a small minority of people. We argued about it for a few years and we saw how small of a minority it was. A lot of the talk back then was about sidechains. I think that, and the Lightning Network in many ways is a sidechain, and that we've seen one of them come up in prominence and in durability, and that does change what we're able to do now. This isn't 2013. This isn't 2014. It's a whole new world out there. And the tools that we have at our disposal are, it's an order of magnitude, if not more, better than in 2013 or 2014. It's just not the same.
Yeah. And look, I'm all about seeing more people earning with Bitcoin. So I'd love to see more people do this. The more stackers there are out there, the more this virtuous cycle continues. So let's see that grow. And before we finish up, Will, where can people find you?
Pretty much, Twitter is the main place. I'm at Will Cole on Twitter, also on Noster. Despite my business partner's famous distaste for Noster, I love it. And so I'm Will Cole there. You can find me. I'll tweet out my MPub at some point here. I think it's in my profile as well. Yeah, just hanging out in those two places.
Fantastic. I'll put the links in the show notes, and thanks for joining me, Will.
Hey, thanks, Stefan. Have a good one.
Show notes are available at stefanlevera.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the Citadels.